You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 17th of December 2011, right here on Monocle 24. The Review is brought to you in association with J.Crew. Hello and welcome to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé and Gillian Tobias.
Ahead in the next hour, we'll be talking about and listening to Christmas songs, the good, the bad, and what they all have in common.
And also this week, once again, we'll be touring bookshops around the world, and we're going to be traveling to Bangkok and Amsterdam and Mexico City.
Dutch erotic literature hasn't been there for ages. I've never seen it before. And actually, it's quite a good read.
Well, of course, if it was erotic, it was from Amsterdam. That was Herr Pohl from Athenaeum Bookhandel in, of course, Amsterdam.
And joining us around our studio table for our weekly magazine review will be Stephen Watson, founder and head of Stack Magazine Service.
All that and much more right here on The Review on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House in London with me, Tyler Brûlé and Gillian Tobias. Hello.
Hello, Tyler.
I'm feeling a bit speedy this morning, Gillian.
I'm amazed. I even see you around this table. I'm speechless about your last 24 hours. Can you just explain?
Well, no, it is funny that I was here, less than 24 hours ago, maybe. I know I had to zip off to Toronto yesterday. So I flew over to Toronto yesterday, had a meeting. Got back on the plane just as the mercury was dropping, and now I'm back in London, and then we'll be heading off to Canada and other points in the Commonwealth from Monday.
Okay. So, and what was the mood over in our homeland?
In Canada, it's so funny because I really felt that London was really wrapping up for the season. You know,
as we have
primarily. But you know, it's interesting because everyone is like in Canada, it's like it's still the next week because, of course, you know, everyone's working right up until the 23rd. I can't believe you stopped working. So I'm looking forward to going over next week and just I'm going to be at home. Okay. Christmas was going to be in Switzerland. It's now in Toronto, but that's okay.
Good.
Yeah. Mom's flat was looking cozy and it should be good. And you?
Well, I'm here and actually looking forward to actually having a whole week to just be in London, enjoy the pre-Christmas atmosphere that's here. And then on Boxing Day, I'm going to South Beach, Miami, because I just felt in the need of some sun.
Right. Okay. which is good because we had one of our booksellers from there last week. It'd be nice to pot around in Miami.
Well, you know what? I was sort of looking at all the different destinations where I could fly direct. And you know, the cross between having covered Design Miami recently and the booksellers and just the mood I'm in, I just thought it'd be quite fun. They have some good galleries there. They have the Design District, so
Absolutely.
It's a mixture of this.
And it's also it's a good time of year to be there as well because you've just got, you know, so many people are visiting from Brazil and, you know, from all over Latin America as well. So the mood will be good.
Well, funnily enough, I'm actually meeting people from all over the world and we just decided it was a good central point, especially the people migrating the cold up in Canada, my old CBC friends.
Who are going down to meet you.
Yes.
Oh, that's nice. No, the one thing when I was around in Toronto yesterday, though, I was at the airport and I was trying to sort of do a bit of a trolley dash for magazines to discuss on the program today. But as you can see, there are no stacks of magazines from any store. It's funny that there's, and I know we've been, you know, over the past few weeks, you know, we've been looking at magazines from all over the world, but we've talked about Australia and we just do not have that type of publishing in Canada that's going on in Australia at the moment. You know, there's so many magazines, whether it's sort of Frankie or Collect, etc. There's so many interesting things happening there. I just don't see them come
But that's out. Why the international magazines at the big booksellers do so well, because they're just hungry for good magazine content.
Absolutely. Everything is of it very much just feels like an extension of the US newsstand, and they slap a maple leaf on the cover but what comes out, it's same format, same paper stock, and really sort of feels like it's
Do you think their energy goes in the newspapers with the National Post and the Star?
Well, I think that they're, you know, because Toronto, okay, yes, some of them are national newspapers, but I think because, you know, you have the National Post, you have the Toronto Star, and you have the Globe and Mail, and of course you also have, you know, you have the Sun as well. So it's actually quite unusual in North America. I think maybe it's almost it would be an exception, kind of. I mean, I guess you could say other than New York, but that you have four city-based but also national newspapers.
Still miss a good Sunday. They're missing a chick there.
I know. I think that's a huge opportunity. I'm not rushing back to Toronto anytime soon to start up a Sunday paper. But you're right. I think that idea, because so many people in Toronto, they pick up the New York Times
they
on a Sunday.
They default to the New York Times.
Yeah. So opportunity. You could do it, Gillian.
Yeah. Well, we'll be back soon. You're listening to the Monocle Review here on Monocle 24. In a moment, we hear from booksellers about the titles doing particularly well in their part of the world just before Christmas, after this.
Well, now it is time to hear what's selling at independent bookshops around the world.
This week, we sent our correspondents to their locals in Mexico City, Bangkok and Amsterdam. And let's take a look first at Mexico City.
My name's Grant Cogswell, and I'm the founder and proprietor of Under the Volcano Books in Mexico City. We are the only used English language bookstore in the second, at least, biggest city on Earth. And we sell a wide and deep variety of English books, fiction, poetry, drama, history, translations, art, biography, memoir, politics, cities, travel, film, punk, queer, expat lit, criticism, technology, psychology, and philosophy, and trash. We kind of have a hot seven, the books that we just cannot keep in the store. Number one with a very fast-moving bullet is Roberto Bolaño's The Savage Detectives in English, which is really coming, really starting to be recognized as one of the best books of the century, I'd say. And the English translation is amazing. I finally got a chance to read. That's number one. And after that, Lolita, The Great Gatsby, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and Grimm's Fairy Tales. I think I named the store after my favorite book of all time, Under the Volcano by Malcolm Lowry Books, underthevolcanobooks.com.
And that was Grant Cogswell, who runs the bookstore Under the Volcano, as he mentioned, in Mexico City's very historic La Roma district, which is really a lovely, lovely neighborhood. Why don't we head over to Thailand now?
My name is Amnath Ratanamani. That is a very long name of Thai people, but you can call me Num. Num is my nickname, so just make it easier. I am the owner of the bookshop called Passport Bookshop, or in Thai we call it Nangsue Dern Thang. So Passport Bookshop in Bangkok. And I think one famous Japanese writer that is popular everywhere and in Bangkok also is Haruki Murakami. Thai people just gone crazy with him for the past few years. The book called Very Thai is about, you know, Thai culture, but from the point of view of Westerner. We have a new book about freeing Burmese political prisoner that has Suji on the cover. Something like that. That is just has been released last few weeks or something like that.
That was Noom, I'll use his nickname, from Passport Books in Bangkok.
It's incredible over the last, I guess it's edition 10 or 11 that we're doing of this program, how much Murakami comes up. I mean, literally mm-hmm. in every single program, I think, as we've sort of pinballed around the world, you've had someone named Chekki Murakami one of their top sellers.
And in unusual places, ones that you wouldn't expect.
No, and it's funny because when we did the Soft Power survey this year, we talked about a lot of things, you know, from Japan, you know, particularly sort of, you know, music and other things, which were obviously, you know, important and powerful in the power of Japanese food. But oddly, you know, we didn't look at, you know, we looked at power of Murakami in the artist, but not the author. So anyway, it's just, it's one to add to the metrics next year. We are now going to Athenaeum Book Handle, which is one of my, we can talk about it a little bit afterwards, but it is true. It is one of these shops, Julian, that we definitely need one of these around the corner as well.
My name is Herm Paul. Well, we're in the Athenaeum Bookshop on the Spuy Square in Amsterdam. The Athenaeum Bookshop has been in existence since 1966, and it's one of the largest independent bookshops in Holland. And, well, I work here. There has been several houses, actually, and we've redecorated them in 66 and have expanded during the years. So now it's quite a large bookshop. Well, it's the end of December at the moment, so everybody's looking for Christmas presents, and especially popular, strangely enough, is the Nederlandse erotische literatuur in 80 en enige verhalen, written by Elsbeth Etty. An anthology of Dutch erotic literature hasn't been there for for ages. I have never seen it before, and actually, it's quite a good read. Although being able to write on sex, on love, is the most difficult thing to do, I'd say. And there is a book that's called The Tori van Matti, which isn't exactly a proper Dutch. It's the Gospels of Matthew, but being put into street language, which is bizarre, but quite interesting. Yesterday we had Jeffrey Eugenides visiting Amsterdam doing a lecture, and his book The Marriage is a huge success in Holland at the moment. Well, I haven't read it myself entirely, but it's a book about American students that are trying to read the modern philosophers, but there's this one student that has a love for older novels, for the Jane Austens, for the Charlotte Brontes, etc. Great read. And to end, we have A New History of Amsterdam by Peter Jan Knechtmans. And of course, there's lots of histories of Amsterdam in print, but this is a good one. It's illuminated with lots of pictures, lots of drawings, lots of paintings, and it does give quite a good picture of Amsterdam through the ages. Well, in the window, what do we have in the window? We do have hundreds of books in the window because people like to make a choice during the Christmas season, of course. And we have a book about that's called Het Muizenhuis. It's actually a children's book, but it's by a Dutch writer who has made a house filled with self-made wooden mice that live in that house. And it's art and it's children's book in one. Great book.
That was Herr Paul from the Athenaeum book handle in Amsterdam, which I gather you know well.
Yeah, I know. If you remember a few weeks ago when Gerrit Jonkers was here from Fantastic Man, he was talking about it as one of his favorites. But what's nice is that it opens out onto the street. And I think as Mr. Paul was saying, that you know, at this time of year, obviously putting, you know, just, well, so much in the windows, but also a lot of it just spills out onto the street as well. And it has this...
Nice.
Yeah, and I think that he's got this great balance of it sort of because it's open to the street and there's some great cafes around the corner, of course. And he's got this almost this very small square, so you can just, you know, you can pull up on your bicycle, and it's, you know, there's been nice trees out in front, and it's you know, and again, it has that sort of hub environment. You know, it'd be very difficult, I think, to replicate. It seems very uniquely Amsterdam, but you know, as an independent, and just, you know, his selection of magazines is breathtaking. And I think also has, as he was pointing out, I mean, you know, their selection of not just fiction or nonfiction, but also pictorial books is it's lovely, lovely, lovely spot.
I'm looking forward to my next trip to Amsterdam because our whole section D this week is Dutch themed. And we did some lovely pieces in Amsterdam and then just a little bit further afield where we talked to the graduating students of Design Academy Eindhoven. So we have a whole Dutch theme going.
Right.
And it just really made me
to say,
it's very inspiring, you know. They really, they're quite thinkers, they're quite, there's a sort of intellectual sort of side to them, but with soul. So when you talk to these design studios, you can just see how the whole nation then, that comes through in the cafes, in the little museums, in the stores, which I always recognize every
it's
time.
It's interesting also how sort of Holland just sort of quietly gets on with it.
Yeah.
Because also, you know, when you start to sort of dig down, you see sort of the power that still, you know, the Dutch, you know, industrial base still has, you know, when you sort of look at the likes of, you know, Unilever and Royal Dutch Shell, etc., and then the power of, you know, Eindhoven, and of course a brand like Philips, and actually, you know, for the size of little Holland, it definitely punches above its weight.
And you sense they do want to stay. You know, they're quite happy, you know, building whatever they do, whether it's a small business or a big business. They like the base of Amsterdam.
No, and the other thing I noticed there, you know, as well, it's, you know, it's also, you know, it's still a big hub. I mean, partly for tax reasons, you know, that might change, but certainly as a hub for, you know, I mean, major sort of multinationals who want to have a European base. I mean, the number of Japanese companies that are there, you have to think about, you know, Wieden and Kennedy's, you know, European operations.
Well, that's
there,
one of our stories. It's Creative Amsterdam. It's about all the advertising agencies that have decided to base themselves in Amsterdam and why. It's a really good piece by Louis Stoddard in Section D.
Okay, so
exactly
people,
on that.
So people can, of course, go and check out Section D, which is on our time shift. Of course, you can also go and download it from iTunes, but on the top of iTunes, it's time for a little bit of music right now. We're going to have our global review of songs right after this break.
J.Crew is thrilled to be shipping across the pond to our customers in the UK. Shop our famous collection of colourful cashmere and wardrobe staples for men, women and children. At J.Crew, you can always expect impeccable quality, design integrity and flawless customer service every time you shop. Visit jcrew.com for the full story.
We have 7 Monocle shops around the world, in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Osaka, and 2 in Tokyo, where you can find a full range of Monocle products, perfect for a Christmas gift for your loved ones. We're now carrying the latest in Monocle collaborations, including Drake's winter gloves and scarves, Anderson Anderson sailor sweaters, Velextra grip wallets, Todd's passport holders, and of course, the Monocle 24 Revo radio, so you can listen to us in high fidelity sound. So at home or away, drop by a Monocle shop. We'd love to show you around.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House. You're listening to The Review with Tyler Brulé and Jillian DeBias. We're now joined by Frances Morgan, a music journalist who writes for the likes of Freeze in these times and is also a film writer for the well-respected Sight and Sound. Welcome.
Hi, thanks.
We've roped you in this morning on the Saturday, Saturday afternoon. Still feels like morning to me. to talk about music, we've got a bit of a Christmas theme. It's been interesting as we've been putting the playlist together here and, you know, visiting CD shops and downloading things, etc. And it's incredible how this is something which, you know, which endures, which starts to, you know, pervert itself when it gets to other parts of the world. I was just in Korea, for example, and it's interesting to see that, just the proliferation of then, you know, Korean artists, who are putting out sort of, you know, their K-pop version of music, etc. It's interesting when, you know, Christmas can become so politicized. It's still something great to cash in on.
Yeah.
I wanted to just start by asking you though. I think we've got about 3 songs lined up for you this morning, and maybe just sort of sort of the thinking behind some of your favorite number ones.
My favorite Christmas number ones, yeah. Or the songs that I picked.
Well, maybe just I think Christmas number ones in general, and that whole
and why you're interested in them.
Well, I think Christmas number ones are often not the best songs. The best Christmas songs. The kind of songs I picked was things that were slightly more under the radar and a bit eccentric, and would never have got to number one. My memory of Christmas number ones as a kid, of course, is just like hearing the same song over and over and over again. It's often a time when you hear charity records as well,
right.
Which are well intentioned, of course, but. Almost unlistenable after a few plays.
Yeah. And is it, yeah. I mean, for people also listening as well, I mean, that whole idea of there's the Christmas number one in the UK anyway, which is, to have your pop song, which of course, if you're listening elsewhere, is very divorced from having a Christmas themed song as were. Though I guess there have been occasions when they've overlapped
I think so. Yeah.
Do They Know It's Christmas et al.
Yes.
Which I don't think we haven't managed to play yet. Should we kick off? You've chosen something by John Baker. It's called Christmas Commercial. What's the thinking behind this that we're going to play first?
Sure. John Baker was one of the musicians in the BBC Radiophonics Workshop, which was obviously the sound effects and electronic music department of the BBC back in the 50s, 60s and 70s. And I recently read a really great book about that whole time and the workshop itself called Special Sounds. And it kind of made me go back to listening to some of the music, which I'd heard before but hadn't listened to in a while. And it's incredibly inventive, very funny, very kind of, a lot of the time, very experimental music that was obviously put together for jingles and theme tunes. But in and of itself is often quite, interesting from a sort of electroacoustic composition point of view. This one is probably less so, I guess. It's quite a funny track. It's John Baker. A lot of his music was composed out of real sounds, like, in this case it's a cash register. Other times it might be the sound of something else to symbolise what the theme of the programme is. So I've no idea what this was composed for, but I imagine it was probably a programme about how Christmas was too commercial these days.
Right. Okay, let's have a listen.
Thank you.
And that was John Baker with his Christmas commercial, all at 45 seconds. It's great. I wonder, does the BBC still have a department doing experimental sounds like this? I wonder.
Unfortunately not. It's such a shame. I mean, back in the 60s, that would be the group of people who would like make the Doctor Who theme tune, all those kinds of things. And now I don't know. I imagine the music's probably sourced from outside or whatever. But it was, I think, a really great time for experimental British music, but being done in this.
What a treasure trove, though, to go through the archives.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how did you come across that?
There were a few CDs that were released, I think, probably about 10 years ago that collected various pieces of music from members of the workshop. And it's something that's quite well documented, I think. Although I have heard it said that probably there was tons more music that has obviously
just disappeared.
Yeah, people taped over it.
No, it's wonderful. It's interesting to hear sounds like that again, because there's a whole generation who haven't even woken up. You know, they've had sort of they've grown up to, you know, just the sounds of sort of, you know, the digital beeps, but not sort of this analog world of, you know, the till actually, you know, opening and the sound of that sort of, you know, that bell as well. That's it's a great piece, and you sort of wonder as well, you know, if you look around. Public service broadcasters, you know, I wonder if our friends in Australia or if Sveriges Radio or whether CBC in Canada, whether they still maintain departments like this. One would hope.
It would be interesting to find out, I think.
Or whether it endures in Poland or somewhere else. You have something by Roger Lavern and the Microns, Reindeer Ride, it's called. Where did you find this?
I guess I was just following my train of thought, which was kind of eccentric, homemade-sounding 1960s Christmas music. And I knew that Joe Meek, the legendary British producer of that time, I knew that he must have produced a couple of Christmas tracks, because it just would have been inevitable, I think, as a pop producer in the 60s, that you would have done some Christmas hits. So I did a bit of digging and came up with this one, which I really like. I mean, it's very kitsch and it's very throwaway, but there's something slightly wrong about the piano sound. It sounds as if the piano's really out of tune or kind of, you know, reverbed really funny. So it kind of has that slightly poignant homemade, spliced together Christmas feel, which I like.
So this is Roger Lavern and the Microns with Reindeer Ride. And that was Roger Lavern and the Microns with Reindeer Ride. And we're chatting to Francis Morgan here for our review. That's great. There's something sort of, you know, vaguely, you know, 60s, you know, variety show. It also goes further back. It sounds a bit sort of vaudeville-esque as well. It's lovely.
Yeah, I think a lot of Joe Meek's productions had that very kind of poignant, you know, British vaudeville.
Yeah.
You know, you can see in the provinces.
Yeah.
Very much, very vintage.
Yeah,
I feel
absolutely.
Do you think, you know, today, and I just, you know, when you look at, I think when you sort of listen to sort of the output of radio and I guess sort of, you know, what the offer is, you know, do you find we're in a time of more exploration and discovery because you can download anything, because, you know, in many ways, you know, we always say, yeah, there's lots of recommendations. If you like this, then you like this and all of that. But does that almost, in a curious way, almost sort of channel people? Because, you know, oftentimes, you know, there's going to be the discoverers out there who are really going to work hard. But, you know, I think we're sort of moving into so much of a recommendation world that if that's actually, you know, less experimental, I don't know what your view is on that.
It's a hard question to answer, I think. You're right, there is a lot out there. There's more out there than there ever has been. And I think one of the side effects of that is kind of more of a niche, you know, effect of channeling people in more and more into niches. But I don't know, I think there's also more scope for kind of happy accidents when it comes to listening and you know, being able to follow a thread. So if you do hear an intriguing piece of music or an intriguing sound, you're much freer to follow that to wherever it might lead you. So perhaps there's more sort of scope for serendipity.
Yeah, well, one would hope so. But Julian, I don't know, do you think that, you know, when you get recommendations, you know, when you look online, and I find I'm increasingly skeptical because I'm not sure if they're commercial recommendations, because there's, you know, there's not sort of the degree of transparency that, okay, was this paid for in terms of recommendation behind the scenes, or was this really, you know, the power of the crowd managed to suggest it? I don't know what your thoughts are.
Well, I either do recommendations from friends, or I'm very old-fashioned. I go to the record store. I like the cover of the CDs.
Yeah.
I like the graphic on the CDs. If I go somewhere like Rough Trade in Brick Lane, I like to put my headsets on and listen. I don't like the online recommendations.
Yeah.
They don't grab me. But I was wondering for you, what in 2012, what you're going to be looking at, is there this coming year?
As a music writer?
Yeah.
Oh, there's so much going on. I mean, it really is. I think kind of as we were saying, really, there's just so much music out there that the thing is to try and find those things that, I don't know, speak to you kind of beyond the things that get hyped on the blogosphere, for example. There's always a lot of music that is talked about more than it's listened to, almost. Mm. And I feel there's a sort of point where you have to learn to filter that a little bit and just think, well, just because tons of people are putting this on their Tumblr, you know, what does it actually sound like? Does it sound any? And you almost have to get away from, I think something that all music writers have to try and do is get away from their screens, get away from their computers a bit, and
I think it's interesting
in different environments.
As you're saying, you know, there's one thing which is part of the conversation. Everyone wants to be attached to it, and they want to sort of name drop, you know, a group. But as you said, have they really sort of engaged? Do they, you know, are they passionate about it, and do they love it? And I think that's a really interesting point.
Yeah, I mean, and does it stand up away from that conversation, away from that online conversation? I mean, for me, I think one thing I always try and do every year is try and see as much live music as possible, because not in any sense that I think that it's more authentic, or, you know, all these kinds of problematic ideas about what music is or isn't, but just because you are at least then in a social setting and you're with other people, and I don't know, I think that's really, really important.
And it's a little bit like seeing a film before it's been released, before the reviews come out. So you don't have any preconceptions. You know, there's no hype, and you can come at it with your own impressions. And that's the great sense of discovery, I think, probably in what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a balance between keeping aware of all these different things, the different kind of micro genres that are always being written about and talked about, understanding all these things, but then also sometimes just trying to forget them as well, especially with, I mean, electronic music and dance music, things that I'm quite interested in. You can get very caught up in saying, well, is this like post dubstep, or is this kind of house, or is it, do you know what I mean, like kind of talking about different genres without really engaging sonically, which is the main thing, I think
that raises an interesting point as well, because I just, you know, that idea of live, and Julian, as you were saying, that you just, you know, to go into, you know, a performance space and you just, you don't know what you're going to get. Okay, fine, you might have read one review, or there's a recommendation that got you there in the first place, but there isn't all of the chat around it. And it was funny, we're, you know, obviously kicking off from next week, we have the Monocle Winter Series, which combines live acts, which we do beyond that studio over there, which is, there is a certain excitement, you know, when we really do it raw, and, you know, there are no nets and there are no wires, and you go for it. It was, and one of our guests, the very quotable Peter York, I liked how he just said, you know, that live is the new black, which I thought is interesting. And we've been talking a lot about, you know, even many people have said, you know, why do you do this program that we're on now? Why do you do it live? Why don't you just go and record it and do it as a podcast? But I think it gives you a different sense of discipline. And I think, you know, that, of course, that very much goes for music as well. There's one thing about being in the moment and having to do it, or relying on, okay, we can just go do it again and again and again. We're gonna have to leave it there, Frances Morgan, but thanks for joining us. This is a little something for you. I'm not sure if you know this, but we're going to play, this is Naomi and Goro. We found them in Japan. We've been playing them a little bit about them, but these are sort of, I guess in many ways, they've become sort of our Christmas anthem singers. But I want to wish you a very Merry Christmas. Hopefully you come back.
Thank
it was great. It's great
Thank
to have you.
You
here.
Thanks.
And this is indeed Naomi and Goro with Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
And have yourself a merry little Christmas.
is Naomi and Goro with Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas here in Studio One at Midori House. You're listening to the Monocle Review with Tyler Brulé and Gillian Tobias. We're going away for a short break. We're back after this.
J.Crew is thrilled to be shipping across the pond to our customers in the UK. Shop our famous collection of colourful cashmere and wardrobe staples for men, women and children. At J.Crew, you can always expect impeccable quality, design integrity and flawless customer service every time you shop. Visit jcrew.com for the full story.
Monocle 24 より Merry Christmas!
Feliz Navidad de Monocle 24.
Frohe Weihnachten von Monocle 24.
圣诞快乐从 Monocle 24.
Joyeux Noël de la part de Monocle 24.
Καλά Χριστούγεννα από το Monocle 24.
Tale da Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé and Gillian Tobias. And you were listening to the review, whereas it's now time for, I think it's this has become, not that I necessarily listen to all of our feedback, but in terms of feedback, I think not one of, I think this is people's favorite part of the program. And to wrap out and round out the year, we're joined by Stephen Watson, who's the founder and head of Stack Magazine. And for those who are not familiar with Stack Magazine, it's a very interesting concept, which I personally like because it's curatorial, but it's also dictatorial. You sign up, you subscribe, and Mr. Watson sends you what he likes.
That's right.
Is that pretty much how it works?
Exactly right. So, yeah, you never know what you're going to get next, but you do know it's going to be a very beautiful, hopefully intelligent, independent magazine that you probably wouldn't have seen before.
Right. And what was the idea that you just, was it, in, you know, I think it may be sort of aligned with what we see as well, that you're just frustrated by, I guess, yeah, I mean, just the commercialization and the payola that goes on at major newsstands, and it was just a sense of lack of discovery. And was it a reflection of this country first or everywhere?
Well, so this started because I used to work on some of these independent magazines. So I used to write film reviews and features for Little White Lies, for example, which is actually one of the better known ones. They're distributed in Smith's. But people still didn't know about it. You know, this is like sort of friends of mine who are into film and really should know that this magazine is out there. They just didn't know about it. And it kind of, it made me realise that there's no problem with the product. You know, there are loads of fantastic independent magazines and there are more, you know, kind of every month they just keep on coming out. But the problem's with the distribution because, you know, the newsstand is made for big mainstream magazines who can afford to take a gamble and print 20,000 copies and pay for distribution in the right places. And if you're making a magazine where, you know, kind of you might have to put your flat on the line for paying for print, you can't just afford to say, all right, well, I'm going to sort of print 20,000 copies and we'll see if they sell.
Exactly.
So Stack started because I thought it would be, what a good idea to just sort of give people a selection every month.
But I think also it is the curse of this country. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, I go out and speak it oftentimes, you know, very much on the commercial side. I said, you know, ladies and gentlemen, you know, if you think that you're going to be able just to sustain journalism and also your own business as retailers by only going with the safe and sure bets, well, then there's not going to be any upflow of new talent. I mean, where are the new art directors? Where are the new journalists? You know, where are the new editors going to come from if you don't take a bet? And I have to say, though, I think it's particularly a problem almost of the English language world, because it's curious. You can go to even Stockholm Airport and you can find more English language independent magazines
Is that right?
By mainstream distributors, or in Germany or in France, I think, than you do in this country. I think everyone wants to go for, you know, just, you know, what they know is going to sell, and everything is not managed by someone who's passionate about magazines. But it's true. I think it's, you know, these they're managed by someone who looks at just purely at the bottom line, but not that sense of curation.
And understands the magazine addiction that so many of us have.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Were you surprised, though, at the pickup and how many people were like us who were really sort of craving and searching out?
Well, it's funny that it started 3 years ago, actually, this month. And it was something that I did on evenings and weekends just because I wanted to make this thing happen. I was working full time. And so, you know, when you're only able to put that small amount of time into it, it's a very slow burn.
Yeah.
And it still is, you know, it's only part of what I do. So, you know, kind of the there's still a lot of potential. I've got my list of things I want to do for next year, and it's a case of like trying to be sensible and just like pick the things that actually, you know, we can make happen.
How much do you have to go out and buy versus at this point now, I mean, being established that you've really got people coming to saying, look at, you know, I'm going to print 500 magazines in Reykjavik, and you say, you know, yes, no. I mean, so is it sort of inbound or sort of outbound?
It's inbound. It definitely was at first. I mean, Borders was still around when it started, so it used to be me going to Borders and record shops and kind of, you know, other places where you might find these magazines, and then kind of, you know, like have a look in the masthead and ring whoever's there and sort of like explain what this thing is. No. I mean, now it really is. It's people from all over the world. Telling me about their magazine. But then the problem is that I have to be able to send a copy to everybody.
Sure.
So if somebody says I'm printing 500 copies, I have to say, well, that's great, but I'm afraid, you know, come back when you've upped your print runner a bit and we can talk again.
Right. You've got, I think, I'm trying to look over the monitor here. You've got 5 magazines
yes.
for us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We've got 13 minutes.
Okay.
Hit it.
Okay, so first up, we've got Boats magazine, which is made here in London. Well, I said they're based here in London. It's a creative studio, and their idea was that basically they sort of like would get quiet twice a year in the summer and around Christmas time. And so they pack up the studio and they head off to a city somewhere in the world that they think has got a story to tell. So their first one was Sarajevo. They've just done Detroit. And they hire a house out there. They bring a load of their collaborators over with them. They hook up with interesting creative people in that city. And they basically put together a magazine, which it ends. The reason I love it is that it ends up as kind of a mix between, they've got like the wide-eyed tourist who is landing in a city and seeing things that you wouldn't see if you lived there, but they mix it with the real kind of local knowledge and the real kind of locals' enthusiasm. So at the start of the Detroit issue, they've got a fairly long piece by Jeffrey, is it Eugenides?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever said that word out loud. and you know, so like, so they get, you know, kind of a big name writer like him because he's interested in the project.
Yeah, and what's wonderful about it is that it unpacks some sort of very, I think, contemporary, you know, almost commercial themes. So I see, you know, in the front, they've got a great story about just the whole urban farm boom, you know, which is so interesting because as they've had to tear down so many derelict houses, you know, in Detroit. So, you know, that's a really well-documented story, which we've seen, but it's, you know, there they've actually just, you know, rendered it in great photography and it's got this wonderful human touch. And then just, you know, just going, you know, in the back, I love sort of the snapshot of suburbia as well.
Yeah.
And the role that the car plays, you know, within all of that.
Absolutely. And because they, you know, because they go and immerse themselves in this place, you get the urban farm story, but then a little bit later on, you get people saying, well, look, you know, let's not forget, we're not going to be able to turn this city around on the basis of some people by like growing kale. You know, that's great. That's great. That's happening. But we need to do other stuff as well.
Exactly. And just format wise, it's quite a nice boxy. It's a very squarish format. Lovely matte stock.
Yeah.
And it's curious. I think it's something format. Art direction wise, when I look at it, it's, you know, it very much also still feels like something which would come from London. It doesn't feel like, in fact, that this was a magazine done from New York looking at Detroit at all.
Sure.
I think it's definitely got this side of the Atlantic looking across the other side.
Absolutely, yeah. Which I think is kind of, as part of, maybe that's because we're in London that I find that interesting, you know, sort of someone going off and like bringing back snippets of the world.
I think that's what we're still good at in this country. One of the few things. I mean, our magpie culture, maybe.
I love the fact that, you know, they all take a month or two off. They have time off and they don't go to the, you know, Italy or Tuscany, or they're going to places like Detroit
and actually
Sarajevo.
It's a husband and wife who run the studio and that magazine, and they've just had a baby. So they had their, I think, maybe 3-month-old baby out there with them at the time.
Right.
Do you know where they're going next? Do you know some of the other cities?
Well, I think I might be sworn to secrecy, actually.
Okay, all right.
Watch this space.
Exactly. Okay, so that was Boat magazine. What do you have next?
Okay, next up is a magazine called Delayed Gratification.
Yep.
They basically they call themselves the slow journalism movement.
Last, I like that. Slow, yeah, the slow journalism magazine, last to breaking news.
Exactly, and so basically, it's come about as a response to Twitter and 24-hour rolling news, where the imperative is just to get something out there, to say something quickly. What they do is they actually look back at the last 3 months of news, and they go back and they speak to the people who were there, kind of, you know, once the dust has settled, what's the reflection and what are people thinking about it? And you get these really wonderful kind of different takes on stories. They're also, they're one of the magazines that is really, like, they've really worked out how to use infographics.
Yeah.
And so, you get these, I think in that issue there's a graphic showing everybody who's ever been in space. And so Ed, like, kind of represented it on a graph, so you can see that around the 70s there was this huge spike in, you know, everyone was sending people into space and it comes back down again.
Mm. No, certainly from a graphic design and, as you said, you know, information graphics perspective, it's great.
And they get great writers as well. So you've got... Tom Watson is in there writing about when the scandal broke.
Mm.
So you get people who are really intrinsically involved with this stuff.
Well, it's nice for readers, but it's also nice for those journalists, because often the frustration as a journalist is
absolutely.
You do the story, but editors are only interested when it's newsworthy.
Absolutely.
And
so for that's a big part of what a magazine like Delayed Gratification does, because they're independent, they're very small, they can't really afford to pay people very much, if anything. But if you go to a journalist who has been involved with this stuff and hasn't actually been able to tell the story in the way they want to, and you say, well, look, we're going to give you free rein. You know, you tell a story as you see it.
Hmm. They've got a story which is headlined the Dark Heart of Scandinavia. And it looks at the Anders Behring Breivik shooting in Utøya and the bombing in Oslo. But it's interesting how they just do a really great timeline as well. Just also then not just recapping the events that happened in Norway, but also what were the driving news stories at the time as well.
And those timelines run down the sides of not every page, maybe every spread, and actually within it there is navigation.
Yeah.
So the pages aren't numbered once whatever it is, they're numbered in terms of dates. So you turn to the 13th of July, you know, so like you see, oh, on the 5th of August this thing happened. It's a great magazine.
And again, it's not dissimilar in format from Boat, also on a matte paper stock, very, very dense pages from a design point of view.
Yeah.
And an interesting sort of spine treatment that they use, which looks vaguely familiar.
You're going to expect some of that.
And listen, there's loads of it going around. What do you have next for us?
Okay, next up is a magazine called Cagoule. Now, this is made by the people who make Anorak magazine.
Yeah.
Anorak is a children's magazine, which is on stack because I think they're doing something really great. So whereas most kids' magazines are kind of branded properties, Anorak is all about individuality and creativity. And Cagoule is kind of what would happen if the people making Anorak made a grown-ups magazine.
Mm.
So on the cover, you've got kind of this weird abstract pair of breasts.
Yeah.
and there's all sorts of stuff throughout, kind of like poetry and illustration and things that kind of has no reason to be there other than they think it is a fun thing.
Yeah.
And it is genuinely, they've really struck the right tone. They've managed to make something which is really lovely and interesting and funny.
It looks quite crafted.
Well, yes, yeah, so it's designed by a guy called Rob Lowe, I've forgotten his artist name. He's going to kill me. But he also designs a food magazine called Fire and Knives.
Yep.
And it's very, very sort of, yeah, it's very crafted.
How do they sustain this? Because there's no advertising when I look at everything that he does.
Mm.
And it's remarkable that, okay, there's a high cover, not really a high cover price. When you look at the production values in this is it's £10.
Yeah.
So how do they do it? Any idea?
Well, so this first issue is dipping a toe in the water. It's 1,000 copies, so I guess they just took a hit on the print.
Yeah.
Anorak has advertising in there from places like H&M, so I guess that helps out.
Right.
Fire and Knives is all about the cover price. But then that, you know, sort of that's a big part of what Fire and Knives is. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, very, very well done. Okay, the stack is dwindling.
The stack's dwindling. Okay, so we've got Little White Lies, which is a film magazine, which every issue they take one film as kind of the whole inspiration for the issue. The one that we have here is Another Earth, which is a movie about discovering another Earth. And so there's lots of things about kind of mirroring and duality in the film.
This was a big hit in Sundance this year, wasn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And I think it's like it's either just come out or it's about to come out now here. But so in the magazine, they basically made two versions of the magazine, one black out of white, one white out of black. And so all of the features and all of the copy and everything, you can sit with one copy in front of you and it's one way and another one, it's another. Mm. And it's typical of the sort of... I should actually say at this point, White Lies is made by the Church of London, which is who I work for.
Right.
So,
Thank you for the full disclosure, Sam.
White Lies was... As I said, I used to write for them. They're kind of one of the first magazines I really fell in love with, just because of this independence and, you know, the feeling that there's a magazine here which has been made for me.
Yeah, Stephen, and there's a running theme here as well, which is, you know, also boxy, also on matte paper in terms of format. Mm. I know the economics of what we do on matte paper, but I'm wondering, do you think there is... Has everyone sort of found one or two printers in London who can probably get this out at a better price than if they did other formats? I wonder.
I think that this sort of format means that a printer can get a lot out of the paper.
Right.
So basically, you kind of you can maximize the amount of copies you get out of a sheet of paper, which
right.
when you're a small independent is really important.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
We just have a little bit. Do you like Gillian? Just comment on it quickly. Or?
Well, I was just saying. I mean, at least this one it is niche. So in terms of advertising, I think if they stick to the films, it probably there is a good business model here. I'm looking through the advertising here of the kind of films you may not see advertised elsewhere, but would interest people who are interested in this kind of analysis of film.
Exactly. Yeah. And the great thing that White Lies are doing actually is they have these kind of like brand tie-ups with. So for they did a series of film screenings with Grolsch, whereby White Lies readers got to go and see a film for free before it came out, and it was all sponsored by Grolsch, and it was in the magazine. It's a great tie-up. It's one of those examples of when independents can get involved with a brand and actually make it work for everybody. Rather, because you mention brands and people assume, you're just compromising yourself. But
right.
it doesn't have to be that way.
No, I have to ask the question, have you thought about a bricks and mortar store, because I think we always talk about that need still in this city and there's no shortage of other cities around the world as well where there's a forum for this and I think I don't know if you've been to Papercut in Stockholm, which is they lay it out for you in a way which you cannot find in London, and yet I would say a good portion of what you see there is in existence along with French Vogue and all of the other more commercial things that people like as well.
At the Church of London we now have a new office at 71 Leonard Street in Shoreditch, which has a shop front in the front, and at the moment the shop front is a stack of IKEA shelves, but very soon it will be. And Jeremy from Mag Culture is curating a small selection of magazines to sell from there. And we're also going to have events and do other things like that.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for that, Stephen Watson. If people still want to buy gifts, I guess they should probably go to stackmagazine.com.
Go to stackmagazines.com. We can still send out PDFs of gift certificates, so
Perfect.
You will get it in time for Christmas.
Excellent. Well, that is all for the Saturday Review. Also for 2011. Is it not, Gillian?
It is.
but we are going to be back at the beginning of January. But in the meantime, there is going to be... of course, the Monocle Winter Series is here, a program that you and I worked on with our other producer, Marcos Hippie, Three Wise Menus, lots of forecasts which are coming up across the season as well. But in between that, there's going to be 2 weeks of holiday for most of us here at Midori House. I say most because that studio still has to get managed. We are coming up to the top of the hour right now. The news headlines are next right here on Monocle 24.